Welcome to Culture, Talent, and Growth. Join Anish Shah and the Ruckus team as they invite dynamic leaders to share what they've learned about creating lasting culture, attracting great talent, and achieving sustainable growth. Let's get started.
All right, let's get started. Welcome, welcome. Thank you for joining us. We have Ruckus and Rocket Ship HQ coming together to present a conversation on omnichannel strategies for a post-IDFA world. We have some really incredible panelists here to share their knowledge and wisdom, and we are really excited to learn from them.
So, quick introductions. So, my background was actually both in-house and consulting in growth for about a decade, and then started an executive recruiting firm. I'm in New York right now, and we have about a team of 16.
I'm Grace. I'm very excited to be here. I'm currently head of growth at Poppy Seed Health. Just a little bit about that. We're an app-based telehealth solution that provides 24/7 text access to doulas, midwives, and nurses for pregnant people. Prior to that, I've been around in growth marketing for a long time, over 15 years now, kind of straddling between DTC and digital media, mostly at startups. So I've got to do a lot of fun stuff over the years. Right before I was at Poppy Seed Health, so that's The Skim, also at Food 52, Birchbox, Glam Squad, which was another app-based business. And I kind of grew up working at The Knot when it was the OG wedding website. So excited to be here.
Hey, everyone. My name is Evan Woods. I'm currently general manager at DTCO. We are a growth studio who we focus on D2C businesses, you know, ranging large and small. We have about 15 clients right now. Prior to that, you know, I spent most of my time within growth and retention marketing at various D2C startups, including HelloFresh, Ollie Pets, House, and a couple of others. Started my career more on the publisher side at Twitter and LinkedIn, doing more marketing operations stuff, and very excited for this conversation.
Hi, everyone. My name is Shaman Trao, and I'm the founder of the boutique growth marketing firm Rocketship HQ. We work with mobile apps, help them grow. Our portfolio is split between games and consumer subscription apps, manage multiple millions in spend. In the past, I've worked primarily with games, was fortunate enough to be a part of 3 acquisitions, run the podcast, Mobile UA Show, and I've had some of you on the show as well.
Hey guys, my name is Matej Lančarič. I'm in the gaming industry for like 9 years already. Right now, working as a UA consultant / freelancer with the multiple gaming companies around the world. And I have my own creative team of 12 motion designers. And I'm happy to be here. It's amazing.
Cool. What we're going to be talking about today are kind of the changes that have happened over the last year. About a year ago, Apple kind of deprecated some of the attribution capabilities that marketers previously had. And that has turned and thrown a lot of marketers kind of for a bit of a swirl. And so what we're going to talk about is, what have people done over the last year? What have they learned? What are some of the tests that have been run? What are the experiments? How do we sort of all collectively move forward? And a lot of you have registered, have put your questions in the RSVP. And so we've unearthed some of the more interesting questions. But before we get into those, you know, I know everyone has a certain level of, you know, how deeply they're dealing with kind of like attribution on a day-to-day basis and how the changes have affected them. So it's pretty helpful for Shamanth to be here, who's obviously running a really popular mobile acquisition agency, has to deal with the day-to-day, to sort of explain what was capable previously, what happened, and sort of what is capable now.
Yeah, right. You know, at a high level, what changed about a year ago, almost to the day actually, is before 2020, there was a unique identifier. Think of it as a phone number called the IDFA, ID for advertisers. So if you were Facebook, if you were Google, you could see Shamanth's IDFA, which is basically Shamanth's phone number, and say Shamanth made a $2 purchase in this word game. He bought this DTC brand. So Facebook and Google and any advertiser would know exactly what Shamanth bought because they would know Shamanth's phone number. And that phone number, if you will, was observable by all these platforms without Shamanth's consent. About a year ago, what Apple did is say, none of the platforms are going to access this phone number, if you will, without Shaman's consent, right? And that is a huge deal because A, not many users are giving consent. And now Facebook doesn't know that I have actually made all of these other purchases. So Facebook cannot target me nearly as well as they did a year and a half ago. What that means is just as advertisers and marketers, we are having, you know, the performance is just far, far worse than what it used to be just because we cannot target purchasers or high-value users in the way that we used to.
Which is a great segue into the first question. How has your performance changed since the policy changes? So some of you with agency businesses probably get to see across a wide variety of clients and customers who you can see, you know, is there sort of an average, a median, or is it all over the board in terms of how and why the changes have happened, what the metrics are in terms of what has dropped and by what percentage? And like, are there certain things that have made certain companies drop more than others? Like, is it scale? Is the types of products they sell, you know, anything else?
Yeah, I would like to start because I have a very positive view on the whole IDFA change. And since that happened, all the campaigns I'm running at the moment on iOS for the gaming companies, well, almost all of them, is actually way better than before.
Wow.
Because first of all, like a lot of people from the gaming industry, they don't know how to evaluate properly the campaigns. And, you know, because the ATT made it this actually pretty hard, but since they don't know how to evaluate this dropped spend. And now I felt like when COVID started, all the competition was just gone on the iOS side. So CPMs were down, everything looked pretty good. But in terms of like how to run these type of campaigns, I had to go back and forth with the product team and made all the changes in terms of the configuration on the SKA network framework and these type of things. But in general, everything looked pretty good, so I'm fine. I can run these campaigns pretty profitably. And since the ATT happened, I have more work, and I'm pretty happy about it.
That's awesome. That's good to hear. So, what kind of changes helped you get these campaigns? So you said you had to go dig in with like your product and engineering teams. Like what have you sort of been, you know, what have you put in that has helped?
Yeah, so the first 24 hours in games, and especially on iOS now, that is really important. So I had to just talk to the product team and the game teams about how we can grab as many events as possible in the first 24 hours. So for example, we had to implement different special offers in the game so to just capture as many purchases as possible in the first 24 hours and not to just screw up the whole game economy as well. That was really important. So now when I'm looking at the SKA network schema, then I'm able to actually evaluate the ROAS and run even like value optimization campaigns. But it's like, that was a long, long process until I get where I am at the moment.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thanks for that.
You know, just to add to what Matej said, right? So I think how you evaluate campaigns is so critical because you cannot evaluate as deterministically as you used to. In fact, a number of folks we work with, they have grown, they've done well, but they've had to embrace the fact that they cannot evaluate campaigns anywhere as clearly, right? Like a year and a half ago, you were like, oh, this is my ROAS, this is exactly how this creative is doing. Folks who are doing well that we work with are like, you know, there's some amount of fuzziness, but we know we are growing. And I imagine we'll talk about this later, but, you know, folks have embraced some amount of incrementality testing, embraced blended models, you know, blended metrics evaluation. And of course, like Matej said, really dialed in on the first 24 hours, whenever that's possible.
For us at Poppy Seed Health, we actually launched a year ago today. So it shaped our go-to-market strategy. And in some ways, it was a little bit freeing because we didn't have a historical performance and channel mix that we were worried about disrupting. But we also had to look at our first, how we're kind of standing up our paid performance infrastructure. It's definitely different than it would have been had we launched a year prior to this change. So we knew that, you know, sort of the tried and true DTC model with the lookalike audiences on Facebook, et cetera, was not going to work for us. And then also it also kind of had us take a step back in terms of how we wanted to think about privacy holistically, especially with our product. We're touching people in vulnerable moments along their birthing journey. So we actually opted not to do any pixeling at all for app download on Facebook, even though we knew, that the quality wouldn't be as good as it could be. So we just leaned in with a much more web-based strategy, actually, which I think has been really productive for us because there was some education around who we were, what we were, and thinking about this onboarding, lead generation, bringing people into the funnel for our CRM and life cycle to nurture them into subscribers for our product. So not so much a performance change, but it did heavily shape where we invested. And then, of course, I feel like Apple Search Ads was a big winner with all these changes because that became such a fundamental part of sort of our performance mix that I'm not sure if it would have been if not for this change.
Makes a lot of sense. Yeah. I feel like over a year ago when as Facebook and Google had been evolving towards kind of removing deeper segmentation options, a lot of the conversation was around, you know, they're trying to level the playing field so that it's not the best marketers, the best acquisition people who win. You know, it's sort of like you could launch a product and just because you don't have a super senior or experienced acquisition team who knows the ins and outs of these platforms, you know, you could still compete. And that was kind of, I think, where UAC came from, which I think removed some segmentation options from Google. And then, you know, Facebook really pushing a lot of their automation and like AI and machine learning to kind of make the decisions for you on which campaigns to go. So I'm wondering whether a lot of these changes actually are reverting back to where, you know, some of the companies who have access to the best kind of like product engineering data and kind of like acquisition marketing teams can now actually gain some level of higher leverage where the platforms previously were trying to level the playing field.
Yeah. And, you know, I would agree with what you said, Anish. As I think Matej said, a lot of his work was with the product team. And like I said, a lot of our work's been with modeling out the data, just making sense of the data, because again, 2 years ago, the data was all there in the dashboard. Now it's really understanding and making intelligent assumptions, making the right intelligent assumptions about what the data means. And that requires resources and expertise that folks that don't have that expertise are not going to be able to manage as easily. So definitely, I think there's a skew in favor of the more established companies, I would say.
Makes a lot of sense. And then Daniel, so for those who don't know, he's working at an agency that has a ton of, as a general manager agency, has a ton of D2C and e-commerce brands. Have you noticed there's sort of difference between some of the brands you're working across in terms of being affected more than others? And if so, are there sort of like either some raw percentages or just something you notice, oh, companies who do this maybe have gotten affected more so, whether it's size of budgets or being at a certain scale or lots of different kind of like acquisition, offline, online, et cetera, kind of channels, or any learnings from that?
Yeah. So I'd say that it does vary across the board. You know, most of our clients are B2C, you know, some of them are higher price point, but not crazy high price point products, you know, somewhat immediate conversion as well. I mean, a big change as well was the attribution windows going from 28 days to 7 days. So if there is a longer buy cycle, then that makes it a bit more difficult for brands to attribute directly to Facebook. I would say we actually grew a lot during these changes, mainly because our strategies, you know, sort of kind of Facebook core five type of strategies we're implementing already. So a lot of our Facebook structures, for example, are highly consolidated and already were. Or, you know, we were really focused on broader audiences as opposed to interest or lookalikes. So I think a lot of what has become best practice, we were already doing somewhat in preparation for, but really because that's where we saw the best performance out of Facebook. And as you said, it's become much more about machine learning, AI. I think where the brands have succeeded is creative. So if you are able to invest heavily, you know, with, and it's really costly, right? I mean, if you're working with Narrative or Tube Science or so many of those other agencies, they're charging like two or three full-time employees potentially to give you creative, but that is ultimately one of the most important levers now, as we all know, with targeting being less important and having, you know, a ton of ad sets or a ton of campaigns being less important. So I think the advertisers that have done well have been ones that have been able to invest in creative and to do so, you know, iteratively and have the resources and see the importance of it, I think are the ones that have had the biggest benefit. I'd say also ones where they've also invested in other things outside of Facebook. So they've invested in their website. They've invested in collecting email addresses and understanding the impact. They've invested in analytics, even if it's, you know, as simple as GA and last click. They're looking at Facebook as part of the picture, but they know they need to optimize what they own in order to compete. So those are some of the things that I've seen in terms of trends.
Yeah, that's a great point about creative. Have there been any shifts in the types of creatives that are doing well? Like, I think, you know, and also the quantity of creatives that are needed on a regular basis, you know, as marketers are thinking about how to go about creative for, like, let's say the next quarter, you know, is it investing in like a couple of really slick pieces that are really well produced that drive a lot of that brand value, or, you know, just getting a lot of quantity of maybe lower cost, you know, creative out there, but you get to learn a lot more from having them run more regularly.
Yeah, I think it varies. I think a lot of the trends that we've seen over the past few years are the same, which is, you know, UGC, native, creative obviously works well. Of course, there's an anatomy of how to make an ad from the hook, value propositions, testing different value props and the order of those. I mean, that's, you know, pretty much the same and has been for a while. I'd say that a lot more creative testing is important. I'd say that creative that does work for broader audiences is also really important. So not, you know, being too niche, because that's really where I think a lot of advertisers have moved. And yes, definitely more volume. Volume, I think, is important. And, you know, it varies. We have some brands where the founders are just making a bunch of UGC and we're running it across Facebook and TikTok and it absolutely crushes it. And it's super, you know, lo-fi, just works really well. Whereas other brands, they are partnering with these large agencies and are getting batches of 15 to 20 new creatives every week to 2 weeks, right? And sometimes new production, sometimes iteration. So I'd say the tactics aren't necessarily, or I guess the strategy of creative isn't necessarily, you know, super different. But I would say the volume absolutely and investment is different.
Okay. And at the volume and investment, the investment in volume has gone up, and 15 to 20 creatives, that across just Facebook, or do you think that's like a lot? So if someone was trying to like forecast out how many creatives they should be doing on a regular basis, Does that feel like high, like, you know, for someone to do 15 to 20 creatives a week? Or that's kind of now.
I think net new that is pretty high, and that's for, you know, one of our clients is sort of a seven, almost eight figure a month, you know, client, and so they need a lot, right? And things saturate quickly. We've been working internally on sort of, you know, a calculator of sorts of, if you're spending this much a day, you know, how much creative will you actually need? But it really does vary, because there's another client we have. They got onto Oprah's Favorite Things. You know, that's huge. That creative, they wrote it for like almost 5 months, way after holiday. So it can vary, right? But I do think that spend is a big indicator, obviously, of how quickly your creative will saturate. And we do try to triangulate what is that number of video status, et cetera, that we need to constantly have in rotation in order to, you know, combat that saturation.
Makes a lot of sense. And external validation is always really great in terms of creative. I feel like a lot of brands have seen that those creatives tend to do a lot better than just showcasing your product and trying to explain it. So I feel like that's a good clue for a lot of people to go out and like try to get some of those even like high level affiliates, even if you can't get an Oprah kind of hit, even though Oprah's New Things can be a little bit more of like a high level affiliate program, the way it's built out. So yeah, going and getting on the Oprah or Ellen, if anyone can go figure out how to do that, helps a lot. And then Grace, obviously you're marketing like a really high consideration product, right? Healthcare is so important to people and they have to be really trusting of it. Does your sort of creative like strategy now change in that? Maybe like, I think, you know, with high consideration products, you often have to have multiple different ads and multiple different looks to get someone to trust you. But with some of the attribution, not as great as before, does that change a little bit? Or do you feel like you have to like shrink a lot of messages into one ad? Or how do you think about that?
Yeah, we've kind of tried both approaches, actually, because our product is a little bit unique in that it's a health-based subscription, but it also relates back to an acute need, since the pregnant person, the birthing person may have a question or concern at 3 a.m., right? That may be the driver. Or like, do I need this in my second trimester? How do I want to deal with this pregnancy, et cetera? So we kind of sit in an in-between space. When we first launched creatively, though, just doubling down on the creative point. I mean, we've done a lot of investment. We have just an amazing in-house creative team. It's a small team, small but mighty team. So we produce everything in-house. We invested a lot in that. And that has been a big help in performance with all of the, I mean, you can imagine all of the, in the old world, all the visibility that we could have had in terms of targeting new parents, expectant parents, et cetera, that really isn't as robust as it is today, right? So creative has been huge. But since what has been was really successful for us, actually, is we had a video asset that was really emotive and touched on these use cases across the different life stages that we support. That performed the best. We also chopped it up into individual stories. So we had one that was more postpartum, one that was more pregnancy, you know, one that was a little bit ambiguous, like you just found out you're pregnant, you're not sure if you're happy or sad. But sort of the compilation video that showed how we imagined our user and the instances in which they'd reach for their app and go to Poppy Seed Health performed the best, by far the best. And then we found down the funnel that it was actually attracting primarily people in their early pregnancy. Like that was sort of the folks that we're pulling through. So even though we were showing all these different use cases, I think for the user, they're able to kind of foreshadow how that may apply to them. So it was sort of broad in terms of our offering. Actually performed way better than sort of trying to drill in individually. So I don't know if that's a function of how targeting has changed or, you know, but really digging into the emotion and the storytelling and trying to show them where you would be when you would need us, really contextualizing ourselves in an emotional way has been the most powerful thing. And I think it's helped us overcome some of these challenges with targeting for sure.
Thanks for that. Can you explain kind of like what is in one of those creatives that like has done really well? Like what would the end audience see?
Sure. I'm happy to. It's gotten us temporarily banned from a few platforms.
Even better.
even better. Yeah. Nothing. You haven't lived until you've been temporarily, you know, suspended. But we show a woman pumping. We show someone changing a dirty diaper. We show a woman in the mirror combing her hair, and it's some of her hair is coming out, like alluding to postpartum hair loss. We show somebody on the toilet. we show somebody looking at a pregnancy test. So we really get in there, because that was a part of our brand, was like eliminating shame and eradicating shame and taboo among those situations. So those were just really, really, really compelling to users. And actually, the only individual ad that performed almost as well was our breast pumping, where we showed a woman breast pumping. And we use real people, like real people that we actually know. These are not models or professional talent that we use. And that, I feel like, was so resonant. We got just a lot of feedback around, we used a woman who was plus size woman, and we got so much positive feedback about like, you never see this in maternity advertising, you know? So yeah. So occasionally had to, you know, contest a few, this is not adult content, to get those out. But once you did, they performed exceptionally well.
Thank you for those examples. I think that's super helpful. And everyone in the audience can try to do their best to guess which one of those got shut down by Facebook.
Yeah, exactly.
Thanks for that, by the way. And then do you feel like there's sort of like with that creative idea, like how many new creatives you're looking for in a particular week, month, et cetera?
I would just sort of double down on the point around spend. I think it really does heavily depend on your spend, just having been at different brands and at different spend levels. I mean, we're earlier stage. We're sort of on the smaller end spend wise. So we're able to get more life, you know, because there's still so much that we haven't penetrated. But I've been at other places with a heavier spend. You really couldn't run one piece of creative for more than like 4 to 6 weeks. And we usually had 10 to 15 in play. So I think it is spend dependent and audience dependent too. You know, our life stage is dynamic, right? One moment you're in it, one moment you're out of it. So I think we're able to get a little bit more life out of our creative for that reason as well.
Because the spend is low, there's a lot more audience for you to touch. And
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Especially if you know it's working. Okay.
Yeah.
Makes a lot of sense.
From the creative point and gaming, especially if you have a niche game, that you need to frequently refresh the creatives because, well, obviously the audience is really small. Well, not really small, but smaller than if you have a wide appeal game, and then you can just tap into like almost unlimited audiences. So, and that also depends. Mm. And from my point of view, I usually try to refresh the creatives on a weekly basis. And ideally, at least like one or two new creative concepts a week. Also depends on the spend, but anywhere between 100K and almost like half a million spend a month, then you will just need like 4-ish a week, because that's just getting really interesting.
Okay. That's great for a baseline. So like maybe with some of the stuff you're working on, 2 to 4 creatives per week, if you're spending roughly $500,000 to $1 million in that time frame.
Yeah, I think 2 to 4, like below half a million, and above half a million, then you would just need way more than like 5 a week creatives.
Because okay.
That's what I've seen working well.
Okay, great. So to revise that, so $500,000 and under per week, you know, maybe like 4 or less creatives. And then if you're looking at $500,000 or more, then you need 5 or more creatives per week.
Yeah.
If someone is trying to create a baseline of how you think about this.
Yeah. We also work on a weekly cadence basis. And we also find it helpful because we know there's a weekly production cycle that goes, that goes on, like a creative director and strategist. They're like, look, every Monday we know we had consolidated concepts, we had to gather the results. So I think just in terms of an analysis cadence, it helps us have that discipline in having a structured testing process. You know, obviously the quantity depends on the spend, like other folks have a goal. Yep. But irrespective of the quantity, we still try to do it weekly just to make sure we have that rhythm going.
Okay. Makes a lot of sense. I mean, I think the original answer of how people were trying to approach the deprecation was, you know, spread across multiple different channels, especially companies who were incredibly paid Facebook and paid Instagram focused, which was really, I think, almost the majority of D2C companies that I had seen. Yeah, how have all of you collectively thought about, you know, expanding channel mix and yeah, I think the factors have been pretty straightforward, but like, how have you sort of thought about channel mix expansion, thinking like what channels to actually test, et cetera?
Yeah, I can talk to this one. I think, you know, I'd love to say we successfully diversified away from Facebook. It's a small amount of all of our clients' ad spend. It's just not true. And unfortunately, we're all just still reliant on Facebook and Instagram. So I would say overall, budgets have often decreased, and just the idea of forcing budget or seeing sort of this month over month, quarter over quarter, year over year growth, that sort of element, I think, has gone down in more smart media planning around, you know, seasonality, promotions, other things that are happening, and really capitalizing on those moments. Honestly, sometimes diverting those dollars to, you know, CRO, right? Conversion rate optimization, I think it's a big thing as well of how can we, if we can't target or optimize as effectively as before, therefore leading to often lower conversion rates, can we actually impact that off of Facebook, right? Or invest in better measurement, et cetera. So I've seen that happen. And then in terms of actual dollars, you know, I would say the two big channels I've seen are TikTok is one. I think that TikTok has obviously exploded, you know, has been exploding. Its ad platform becoming better and better. And CPMs are just lower. And so, you know, I've seen a lot of advertisers, even one of ours, you know, they have sort of almost six, you know, seven figure budgets on TikTok a month. And, you know, very creative driven, like extremely creative driven, very different from Facebook. But we've seen a lot of success there. And just to have another platform of building that brand awareness, prospecting has been really helpful. And then TV, for sure. TV has been, I'd say, a bigger investment for clients who can afford it. Whereas TikTok, I think, is a lot better for, you know, smaller, sort of smaller brands who still have to invest, you know, let's say 30K for a test buy, but that's, you know, the creative is cheaper and it's easier to get a read. So those are some of the biggest ones, but unfortunately, you know, there isn't saying, you know, we diversified away into affiliate and all those other channels and Facebook becoming a significantly lower portion of the pie. I have not seen materialize for anyone that I've worked with.
That's super interesting. Yeah. And it's not easy to just basically say, oh, great, this channel that was performing great at scale with numbers that we were happy about. Yeah. Another channel is just going to do the same thing. That's not nearly as advanced in their technology, doesn't have as big of an audience, and doesn't have an audience with the same demographics, is just going to replace it. Yeah. There is some level of wishful thinking within that. So thanks for eliminating that wishful thinking.
Yeah, I would say we've seen a little bit of spend away from Facebook, you know, definitely. And it's very vertical dependent. On the number of subscription / consumer apps, we've seen shift to TikTok, much like Evan pointed out. I think TikTok's much stronger outside of gaming. We've also seen a shift to web-based flows for apps. So the apps for which we build web pages or landing pages, direct traffic to that, that's been hugely effective, even if we just use Facebook for that, right? So Facebook is still a channel for that, but that's big.
Can you explain that a little bit more deeply?
Sure, right? So basically, we set up a landing page to basically describe the product. I think Grace, you briefly mentioned something like that, right? And the landing page has a CTA button that goes to the app stores, right? The advantage is that the landing page provides a lot more context. It's a longer copy, which the app store just doesn't provide. So I think that's one reason why that converts much better now. But again, that's, I think, much more effective outside of gaming, I would say.
How did you manage the friction between the App Store and you know, the landing page? Because there is the extra step that you know, people need to take.
That is true. There is the extra step, but at least the metrics we are seeing seem to suggest that having that extra step, it more than, you know, the net metrics are still better than what we would do with the broken tracking with the app install campaigns, yeah, with scan.
Yeah, I can imagine it works well because it's also like uses different optimization methods rather than just MAI or any AEO campaigns that all other companies are running at the moment. And then this creates a way lower CPMs and everything. Okay, well, that would make sense.
Yeah, we've had a lot of success with that strategy at Poppy, with that web-based strategy. It's been awesome for us. And we did some incrementality testing into that just to validate that that was growth we wouldn't have otherwise seen. So that's essentially how we're using Facebook primarily, is driving to our landing pages and then off to App Store.
That's interesting. Okay, great. Which maybe previously you didn't do as much of, or... That would have been a strategy always anyways, because it is getting people to convert a little bit more so.
Well, we didn't need to do that in the past because Facebook would just target past purchases anyway, mm-hmm, because they had the IDFA. And if you have made a purchase in a different subscription app, it doesn't matter if you have the long copy to convert you, because you are a pregnant person. Facebook knows you're a pregnant person. You're going to convert irrespective of how much information you give them.
Okay, that makes a lot of sense. And specifically with mobile, has there been kind of like a return to a lot of these random mobile ad exchanges and networks and trading desks and all of that, where maybe people stopped really using that stuff when Facebook and Google were doing a better job of pumping these folks, or not so much, and everyone's just making these core platforms work? work as best
as they
can.
The bigger ones, yes, on gaming we've seen, and Matej, you can, I think you would echo what I'm saying, to the bigger ad networks. And I think that's primarily because some of these bigger ad networks still use device fingerprinting, which Apple very explicitly forbids, but has not cracked down on.
So yeah, nobody cares if they forbid it. If they, exactly. You know, they use it anyway.
Well, until Apple, you know, cracks down, right?
But until that happens, we can see better results on those ad networks. So let's leverage that.
Exactly. So to Anish, the bigger ad networks, I think the smaller ad networks, Matej, please correct me if I'm wrong, but I don't think that smaller ad networks are anywhere as prominent, at least in my mix, they're not on gaming. But the bigger ones, that's definitely a place where we've diversified spend away from Facebook, because even if Facebook does well, tracking is broken. Whereas with fingerprinting, I know tracking is there. It feels somewhat more deterministic than Facebook is.
Yeah, from my side, I moved a lot of spend from Facebook to Google, Unity Ads, and they are like other ad networks because of the fingerprinting and actually the better results that I could get from these ad networks, because Facebook, honestly, like the quality decreased so much not in the last year, but even before that it even happened. So since then, I just start slowly moving the budgets elsewhere. And since ATT started, well, even though I said like there are still very profitable channels, or the iOS campaigns are still very profitable for me, but still everything around like Android traffic and other stuff that's like trying to diversify even more.
Interesting. Okay. Makes a lot of sense. Yeah. I feel like when I would meet people who run these ad networks or work at them, or even publisher side companies who would be selling ads directly, a consistent thing I'd hear was, well, it's a really shitty business model competing with Facebook or Google. Like, you're just not going to win, you know? And so the ad network model is now really difficult to get anybody excited about. And so now I'd imagine, I don't know, are your inboxes getting flooded a lot more with some of these folks who are like, by the way, we're now a better option than we used to be?
Quick comment on that. Thankfully, I have a UA consultant on my LinkedIn, so I don't put all the companies I work with. So in that case, I have zero inbox from or zero messages from these guys, which is a blessing, really. So, sorry, go ahead, Grace.
No, it's okay. Well, lucky you. I was going to say yes, inboxes. And some of the calls I'm actually taking, which is a big change for the last few years, where probably the last 7-8 years, where I wouldn't even consider it. But it just for direct buy, actually, is something that's become more interesting to us, even at a relatively lower spend level, because we have a specific audience. Looking at media companies or content platforms that aren't super huge, because we don't need you to be huge. We just need you to have an audience of pregnant people and postpartum people. So that, I think we've been more bullish about those kind of paid partnerships that I don't think I would be, you know, if not in this world currently. And just, I know there's been a lot of conversation about TikTok, but we've been way more bullish about TikTok than I think we probably would have been. Well, we could have, you know, still experimented, but not looking at it as an experiment, but looking at it like this could potentially be like an always on big chunk of our effort and spend. I think that was a change in mindset with our go-to-market strategy based on this.
That's fascinating. I wonder, and I also wonder if from the customer side for let's say a product that you'd sell, Grace, which obviously you need to be in a certain life stage to matter to you. If Facebook and Instagram aren't as knowledgeable that you're in that life stage, you're not going to be seeing ads on them. So, you know, if a customer is on a baby, pregnancy, et cetera, oriented website, you're getting a better conversion rate because they're not being pumped with ads from maybe other companies who are doing similar things. So the customer experience might actually be pretty good there.
Yeah.
From not being too inundated from somebody, maybe other companies who do similar stuff as you.
Yeah.
That's fascinating. Have you gone through and done some of these buys, or you're sort of just like looking into them now?
We've done at least two
and
explored some further, and we've had some success there, you know, and I think especially now a lot of content platforms are willing to work in much more, they've had to get creative in terms of how they're going to sell media. So now in this stage where they're more compelling option, it's been a nice like intersection point, you know, so you're able to buy in a little bit more innovative ways because they had to try and remain competitive. And now it's more interesting to use part of the budget and test there to be in front of that audience.
That makes a lot of sense. Yeah. Cool. And you probably get access to some of their like email lists if you really wanted to, or even content that you can repurpose otherwise if they're doing interviews and or like advertorial kind of things.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. There's always a package around it that has some legs. So that's been really valuable for us.
Cool. So it looks like everyone has somewhat expanded channels, but really is still investing quite a bit in the core kind of like paid search, paid social kind of world. So it's like there's a little bit more open-mindedness towards ad networks, a little bit more open-mindedness to buying directly from publishers. But yeah, are there any sort of hidden channels that you've sort of, not hidden, but maybe like, oh, wow, this is a random area. Maybe it doesn't have scale, but it performs really well with the smaller audiences. You know, you hear about micro-influencers, you hear about like smaller affiliate networks, et cetera, that might not, you know, give you the scale, but hey, the numbers look good and you can blend it into your overall kind of like broader CAC.
I mean, we've been working with content creators. Again, it's on TikTok, but that was a good target for us because of the price. It's still a lot of those folks are still emerging, and there's people who have relatively robust followings that have never done partnership deals before, so they're still approachable.
Okay.
We worked with somebody who had 1 million followers, and it was still a very economical, you know, relationship for us. And it was their first partnership deal, and they're still excited. I feel like the TikTokers are still excited. They're less jaded than the Instagram brand, influencers. Then again, I've been in beauty and all this other stuff before, so maybe I'm the jaded one. But it's been great for reach and impressions, and then you can just take that asset and make an ad with it. So we're kind of getting some value on the asset too, that we're not having to produce in-house. So you look at the cost blended, it's pretty efficient. We're getting the impressions from being on their platform. Then we have an ad we can use. And that cost is sort of all blended together. So that's been, I don't think it's that hidden, but it's been like a flywheel that's worked really well for us.
Yeah, we do something very similar. We hire actors and not influencers. Which is a lot more affordable than hiring somebody that has 1 million plus followers. And because we are able to recruit these actors fairly cost effectively, helps us build volumes of creatives, right? And we could test, you know, different appearances, different ethnicities, obviously depending on the product. So definitely I would say for volumes of UGC/influencer-like ads, going with actors or micro-influencers, if you will, rather than actual influencers. I think that's definitely been a huge deal for us.
Yeah, I think similarly, even just whitelisted pages. I mean, we've created pages. We've had really small, like a couple thousand people sort of content pages that are hyper-relevant to whatever the product is, and then whitelisted those, and those have done extremely well. So sometimes it is the, you know, influencer and sort of how well known they are. Other times it's just having a different handle, right, and getting those, you know, CPM and or CTR gains. And then the last thing I would say too is just working, you know, on the partnership side. I'm sure Grace can attest, you know, the Skim, so many other publications. I mean, you're just buying their incredibly bought in audiences. There is no issue around IDFA, and, you know, it is a flat fee, so you're taking on risk. But, you know, if you have the right audience and you're able to activate them, the ROAS, you know, I know for that particular publisher with everyone that I've worked with is just like extraordinarily high. So, you know, relying on other brands and sort of having the right placement, hopefully something that's a little bit more editorial and explains, you know, the benefits of a product or service.
That's cool. And you say, you know, flat fee and whatnot. I mean, when reaching out to so what's really cool is Grace reached out. Sounds like reached out just directly to someone that maybe you found would be interesting for your audience, who has a good following, who your audience would probably be like, this is potentially an authoritative person within this world that we operate in. You know, is that sort of priced at like a pretty flat fee as well, like based on how many followers they have, or it's all kind of based on other things like likes or follows or anything like that?
I mean, yeah, content creator pricing is like all over the place.
Yeah.
It's all over the place. And so many dependencies, so many dependencies. Yeah. Where I'm in right now, we can afford it. We can, those people, even up to 1 million followers on TikTok or even 500,000, we can still wrap our arms around it because of the space we're in. It's so specific. If we even moved out into kids 5 and plus, we'd be probably completely priced out, right? So it's like, because we're able to touch people if they're in that life stage, that may not even be their primary thing they talk about. You know what I mean? It may be a part of their story, a part of their narrative. So we're able to have some savings there. But yeah, I mean, the sky's the limit when it comes to content creator fees.
Yeah. It sounds like you were able to access this person. They're really thankful and they like really were a great partner for you because they were thankful. But like when you look at like the big YouTubers and the big Instagram, they have like professional Hollywood agents that are negotiating all of that for them, right? So that's why I was kind of curious, like, okay, you found someone who was great. You got to go not have to deal with an agent. You know, how do you think about that?
Yeah, exactly. But yeah, exactly. We work directly and we are, you know, being strategic and trying to find folks that I don't want to sound like aren't represented. That's not a bad thing. But for us, where we are in our budget, you know what I mean? We are looking for people who haven't done a lot of partnerships before that have what they've shared of their personal story connects to the product and kind of fit our brand ethos and that we think would be excited about Poppy. And to your point, they are truly excited about what Poppy's bringing to the world. They're excited about having maybe their first or second brand partnership. And it's kind of a win-win for both of us. So that's how we've kind of been able to save on the cost side. So we'll take advantage of that while it lasts.
Yeah. I mean, look, not everyone has the energy to go and find these sort of like wonderful needles in the haystack on their own, right? That's why you go through agencies, platforms, et cetera. But when you do, it really pays off. And I think that's advice that I often give to people for anything. Like if you're hiring an agency to run your ads, if you're doing anything partnership oriented, you know, get someone who's sort of hungry and on the way up and like needs to kind of make a few things successful before they can, you know, start bumping up their prices and scaling and all of that. So you found someone at the right time and it's beneficial for hopefully that person as well, because they can start building up their portfolio. I think Montez, you sort of like dove into that. You've invested quite a bit in redoing your infrastructure. Are there any specific details that would be helpful for someone to understand? Like, you know, if they were to just start going from relying so heavily on Facebook and Google attribution to now building some of their tech in-house, like where would they start?
What changed quite heavily for me, it wasn't about the infrastructure that much, honestly, but about more like trying to think about how to evaluate the whole activities properly, which, well, now properly is very, well, weird word to use, but in terms of the infrastructure, like I work with different size of the teams. So with smaller teams, they don't have the data teams yet, or the smaller companies, they don't have the data team yet. So they rely on the mobile measurement partner like MapSlayer, Adjust, Zingler, or whatever else. And with that in mind, they just need to set up the SKA network framework. And from my side, I worked with different companies before. We had several data analyses done just to try to think about how we should actually set this up. And we went through different conversion schemas. I tested it like millions of times and then eventually came up with just like a revenue schema. We used the purchase that I mentioned before in the first 24 hours. That was really important. So afterwards, the most important part for me is just trying to think about the evaluation. So with the MMPs set up, you just need to think what to set up. From my side, the revenue and the purchases for the gaming companies work the best, or the custom conversion schema with some of the funnel events. For example, you use tutorial completion, then level achieved, and whatever else that you can see that the players are actually doing in order to achieve the purchase in the first 24 hours. And then afterwards, you just use the purchase as an event with a different conversion or the revenue brackets. So you can actually measure the ROAS afterwards.
Okay, thanks for that. Anyone else have any kind of insights into different things you've done within kind of your infrastructure, especially that can help some folks who are just kind of making the shift to becoming a little bit more advanced?
No, I think incrementality, investing in analytics to understand the incremental impact of channels, that is definitely an area where a number of folks we work with have invested. It is something that's increasingly critical, I would say.
Okay. And like what kind of analytics tools do you think would be kind of best in class to start looking at?
There are, you know, the folks that have in-house, you know, the folks that basically run spreadsheet-based models, or they work with third-party incrementality tools, or have their internal data science teams build out incrementality models. But there's different directions they could go in. But at the very least, starting to think about what's the incremental impact of a channel, which we didn't need to do, or, you know, it was necessary, but wasn't really evident when you looked at the metrics in the past. So it's certainly something we're seeing more and more need for.
Okay. How has measurement changed since ATT? Do you feel like there's any kind of like broad sense of answering this question that we in a direction we haven't really dived into just yet? Are you looking at different metrics? Are you looking at anything kind of differently?
Yeah, I can elaborate a little bit more about the evaluation. So different sizes of the companies, very different measurement approaches because, well, for example, the smaller size teams, they don't have the data analytics team, as I mentioned. So right now, what we are doing with the small teams, we're just trying to see what kind of level of spend we have and what kind of level of revenue we can get. So taking the blended approach because, well, there's not anything else that we can really do, unfortunately. And then you just stack the UA channels and then you see what kind of is the difference between the spend versus the revenue you're getting, and then trying to assume, okay, so this is a good good channel, it's producing some revenues or is not. And then with the bigger teams, you have the incrementality tests and the models you can use, which is obviously way, way better, or the media mix modeling, which is the really advanced way of measuring the ATT or the iOS traffic at the moment.
Okay, cool. Well, we're going to be closing up here any minute now, as we're almost at the hour. So if anyone else wants to get in some thoughts on how they've sort of like upgraded or evolved their measurement tactics over the last year, would love to hear about it.
Yeah, I'd say most brands that we work with, sure, some use MMM if they can afford it. You know, it is a lot more advanced and also expensive. But, you know, large brands also use really basic tactics, you know, in addition to obviously GA and making sure that Google Analytics, you know, for web anyway, is, you know, you're getting data from the ad set and the creative and the campaign. You know, how did you hear about us? I'd say, you know, having a post search, a survey, purchase survey, you know, on the confirmation page or an email. I mean, huge advertisers are using it. It's obviously submitted from an actual customer, and you are able to, I think, in a much better way, prove out upper funnel channels, you know, of their efficacy. I think it's become a lot more important. And then, yes, I agree that looking at just blended aggregate and, you know, trying to isolate how much you're spending on one particular channel at one given time and seeing, you know, is there marginal efficiency overall for the business as we're making these larger changes? You know, just that alone, you know, I think that anyone can do, you know, could have a really big impact and allow you to scale.
Thanks for that. Super helpful. Well, this was an awesome chat. I feel like I learned a ton. I'll throw my email address here if anyone wants to follow up or have any questions. If anyone else wants to, feel free to throw your email address in the chat. Thanks a lot, everybody.
Thanks for tuning in to Culture, Talent, and Growth. If you found value in this conversation, please leave a review, subscribe, and share this episode with a friend. You can visit bringruckus.com for more ways to connect. And remember, new episodes come out on Tuesday.